It's Tuesday, January 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Malaysia's Attorney General clears Prime Minister Najib Razak of allegations of corruption over a transfer of $681 million into his personal bank account.
It's become a question where exactly Najib has claimed that it's all been above board, that it's been a gift. When pressed to say who the gift has been from, he's been cagey.
We look at the turmoil in China's financial markets, and we meet three new stars on the music scene. It's all ahead. Malaysia's Attorney General Tuesday cleared Prime Minister Najib Razak of any wrongdoing months after allegations first surfaced that hundreds of millions of dollars disappeared from the indebted state-owned investment fund, One Malaysia Development Bhd.
Saya berpuas hati. Bahwa keterangan saksi-saksi
Attorney General Mohammad Apandi Ali says he's satisfied the evidence involving witnesses and supporting documents submitted by the Malaysia Anti-Corruption Agency that the sum of $681 million transferred into the personal banking account of the Prime Minister was a personal donation from the Saudi royal family given to him without any consideration. Clive Kessler, Professor Emeritus at the University of New South Wales, tells International Edition's Victor Beattie the ruling United Malays national organization has weathered the political storm so far, but its dwindling popularity could prove troublesome in the next national election scheduled in 2018.
Najib and his party won the election of 2013 with cash flows that were strategically dispensed, and there's been a question, where did this money come from? It's become a question where exactly Najib has claimed that it's all been above board, that it's been a gift. When pressed to say who the gift has been from, he's been cagey. For a long time, he has identified it as some Arab source, but there was considerable speculation that it might have been the Saudis. And this is now confirmed and admitted. So we now have at least a confirmation, an admission of the source. It still does not make, for many people, the nature of the gift any less dubious in appearance.
Does this do anything to the long-standing role of the United Malays National Organization?
Well, having the money and having that as a slush fund, a massive slush fund for Najib to dispense, has in the short run put the UMNO in a stronger electoral and political position than it would otherwise have been. But I don't think there's any doubt that the party, its credibility, the credibility of its leadership of Najib has been massively damaged by this, and the very belated and grudging confirmation that the Saudis were the source of this money, far from clarifying or resolving the issue, only raises more questions and makes things look more dubious. The main reason for that is as follows, that Najib has presented himself internationally as a very, very credible Islamic moderate, an Islamic modernist, but he has stayed in power and kept himself in power by cultivating some fairly traditionalist, Sharia-minded, Islamically restrictive political forces in his own country. There's been considerable speculation that those forces have been funded by the Saudis, and Saudi funds have encouraged Najib to consent to that. By confirming this, he's just showing the extent to which he and the Islamist forces to which he's increasingly beholden are themselves creatures of Saudi influence.
Clive Kessler says the controversy shows no signs of waning after Mr. Najib fired his previous attorney general last July and quashed independent investigations. He says while the prime minister has consolidated his power in the short term, the continued denial of all accusations and the ICE and isolating those who make them may not work for him politically in the long term. Well, with a look at how this story is being reported on social media, here's my colleague Susan Yaki.
Thank you, Sarah. Hello, everyone. The Guardian reports that Attorney General Mohammad Apandi Ali told a hastily called news conference he is satisfied with the findings that the funds were not a form of graft or bribery. A statement was issued that said Najib had returned money to the Saudi royal family because it had not been utilized. But it also reports that Malaysian opposition parliamentarian Tony Puah told The Guardian the basis to absolve the prime minister of any wrongdoing is utterly without merit because the personal affair does not preclude corrupt motives or transactions. He added the Attorney General has provided no new or convincing information or arguments on whether the massive funds were bona fide, which leads to the question whether the newly appointed Attorney General is merely covering up for the Prime Minister, he said.
And Susan, what's being said concerning U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's visit to East Asia?
Oh, yeah. Well, Sarah, our favorite website, VOAnews.com, reports human rights concerns and bilateral trade have been focal points for U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who held a series of meetings with officials in Cambodia today. Kerry said progress for Cambodia in the areas of human rights, universal freedoms, and good governance is critical in order to fulfill the potential of bilateral relations with the United States. However, Reuters reports Kerry failed to secure a Cambodian commitment for a more robust stance with Southeast Asian nations against China's pursuit of territorial claims in the South China Sea. And Sarah, also trending today is Republic Day. The Economic Times reports amid tight security, Republic Day celebrations in Kashmir passed off peacefully with the unfurling of the tricolor and cultural programs at various places. And friends, DJ Jyotesh, at DJ Jyotesh tweets, happy 67th hashtag Republic Day to all the Indians from Team Bhushan.
Thanks very much, Susan. That's International Edition's Susan Yockey. This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute.
Japanese scientists say they've developed new technology that will allow a patient's heartbeat to be remotely taken and measured without intrusive instruments such as stethoscopes and body sensors. Working with the Panasonic Corporation, the researchers from Kyoto University's Center of Innovation say under the right conditions, heart information gathered with their remote sensing system is as accurate as an electrocardiograph. The researchers say their new technology will help lead to the development of a number of similar devices that will remotely gather a wide range of medical information from patients as they go about their normal day. Haruki Sakai, one of the researchers who created the new device, says that his team tried to come up with something that would allow people a way to monitor their body in a casual and relaxed environment. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Canada copes with a fatal school shooting. Recent turmoil in Chinese financial markets have investors again looking at how China's economy is evolving and measures Beijing is taking to keep its currency stable. Senior international economics correspondent Carter Doherty with International Business Times joined International Edition's Jim Stevenson to discuss what's happening with the renminbi.
The challenge for the Chinese has been to manage the downward slide of their currency in a way that doesn't upset the rest of the world or encourage additional flight of money out of China. That's proven to be a real challenge because the Chinese don't have a long history of communicating well with financial markets or communicating at all for that matter. And also, frankly, because there's a lot of Chinese that would like to get some money out of their own markets. So they're to some extent up against the pressure of their own people.
In the United States, we're very familiar with Chinese investors in real estate because they feel that is a good place to put their money. How much money is flowing out of China and what is Beijing trying to do to stop it?
We don't know 100% exactly how much money flows out and when. We can take a look at the foreign exchange reserves of the central bank and guess at some of the outflows. And those reserves were down by about $100 billion in the month of December, which tells us there was flight of money out at a pretty good clip. The challenge of the Chinese these days is to take their financial markets to the next level and convince what you might call patient long-term investors, these are insurance companies, pension funds, and other central banks, that China is a good place to to put your money and that you can leave it there despite periods of occasional volatility. But that in turn involves things like opening the Chinese bond market more to foreign investors and transparent, clear regulatory regime. And the challenge in all this is fundamentally that those involve giving up a measure of control, and that's something the regime in Beijing is not terribly comfortable with.
Beijing has tried to set up special economic zones, one most recently in Shanghai. Is that having an effect?
Those are more experimental places where the Chinese sort of fiddle around with what might be possible on a broader scale. So far, I haven't seen a lot of evidence to suggest that those are runaway successes in one direction or the other. But again, even if you find to have a successful experiment in Shanghai or elsewhere, whether you want to propagate that, you know, through the entire country and relinquish a measure of control, that's another matter. It's a political decision, and nobody really knows exactly what the President Xi Jinping has in mind.
What are some of the areas where money is actually flowing into China besides trade?
Well, the challenge of the Chinese these days is to convert from an export-driven manufacturing economy to one that is based more on services. And that's certainly not impossible, but the challenge will be moving that along quickly enough to accommodate a kind of new normal in which China maybe exports less, but Chinese consumers use more domestic services. And that can be all sorts of things, you know, whether it's retailing services or medical services, you name it. And there is a good chance that the Chinese will pull this off. It probably means the end of the sort of meteoric growth rates of 10% per year, but that was bound to come down at some point.
Carter Doherty is a senior international economics reporter for International Business Times. Carter, thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
My pleasure.
And that's International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Hundreds attended a church service in Lachish, Saskatchewan, Canada, Sunday to remember four victims, two brothers and two teachers, of a school shooting in the remote village of less than 3,000. A 17-year-old boy, whose name is being withheld because of his age, appeared in court Monday and was charged with four counts of first-degree murder and seven counts of attempted murder after Friday's shooting in the Aboriginal community. No motive for the shooting has been made public. University of Toronto political scientist Peter Lowen tells International Edition's Victor Beatty such tragedies are rare in Canada.
The mass shootings like this on their own are very rare, and this is the first case I know of one where which has occurred in an Aboriginal community.
A police superintendent in Saskatchewan said, quote, "This is a significant event for Canada. It's a huge impact on the community. It's a part of changing times. We are seeing more violence." What might he mean?
What he's really getting at is that for a lot of these communities, especially in the north of Canada, they're deeply isolated places. They're places where people's life chances are more constrained or more limited than they are in other places. And they're places, frankly, with a greater incidences of violence and addiction and despondency in some cases. So I think what he's really getting at is he's sort of describing the turmoil of a lot of these northern communities.
Prime Minister Trudeau last month promised a new nation-to-nation relationship with so-called First Nations peoples. What does that mean?
Well, what he means is that he intends for the federal government to deal essentially on the level with our Aboriginal communities who refer to themselves as First Nations, and we refer to them as our First Nations. And traditionally, they've been in some ways subjects of the Canadian state. And so what Mr. Trudeau is signaling is that he wants the federal government to deal with these Aboriginal communities as equal partners rather than as being subjects of the federal state, which is a big shift in approach.
Is this all poverty related?
No, this is a very complicated thing, I must say, that Canada has a very checkered history with its Aboriginal people. We had a report come out last year which said that the system of schooling that we had put in place for a century, in which Aboriginal kids were taken from their homes and were brought to schools in white towns, was a form of cultural genocide. That's probably a fair description. So to say that Canada has a checkered history with its Aboriginal peoples is to just to put it mildly. And that continues to have very negative effects on the lives of Aboriginal people in Canada. It's not only about poverty, but it's about a deep problem within our country about what opportunities we give to Aboriginal people and what kinds of lives they can live in Canada.
Robert Nault, who served as Aboriginal Affairs Minister under the Liberals from 1999 to 2003, is quoted as saying, "We're going to have to be patient and start working on the lack of infrastructure, lack of housing to change our relationship as it relates to education and health care. It's a slow process."
I think that's a fair assessment. I think anyone who suggests that they know the solution or the solutions with certainty for kind of addressing some of the real serious problems that Aboriginal communities face is not being truthful. I don't think anyone knows for sure what to do. I think we have to try a lot of different things and we have to have a lot of goodwill. But this is the thorniest, most difficult political problem we have in our country.
That's Peter Lowen of the University of Toronto. He says compared with similar mass shootings in the United States, this appears to be an isolated incident, a matter that has more to do with community despondency than the prevalence of guns. The Canadian-based National Post says the suicide rate in these northwest communities, like La Touche, is more than triple what it is across the entire province of Saskatchewan. This is VOA.
Hello. I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
My name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Now for some entertainment. Here's Steve Norman with a look at three new stars on the music scene who could make it big in 2016.
Born and raised in the U.S. city of Phoenix, Arizona, and now singer-songwriter Casey Hill is making music on Conway West's Good Music label. Casey Hill worked as a model and then a dancer for one of Kanye West's tours before recording music as an alternative rhythm and blues artist with such hits as Arm's Length. Born in the British county of West Sussex, singer-songwriter Tom O'Dell always knew he wanted to do what his idols did. Big into Elton John, Leonard Cohen, and Bob Dylan, O'Dell's songs have been described as emotional and raw.
I wanna take you somewhere, so you know I care, but it's so cold and I don't know where. I brought you daffodils on a pretty string, but they won't flower like they did last spring. And I wanna kiss you, make you feel alright. I'm just so tired to share my nights. I wanna cry and I wanna love, but all my tears have been used up on another love, all my tears have been used up on another love, all my tears
lips have been used up on another love, another love. Oh, my tears have been used up.
And then there's Dua Lipa. Born in Kosovo, now living in London, her singer-songwriter skills have pushed her to the top of the downloads charts with such hits as Be the One.
I see the moon, I see the moon, I see the moon. Oh, when you're looking at the sun. Not a fool, not a fool, not a fool. No, you're not fooling anyone.
Dua Lipa sings what's known as Cosmo Pop, somewhere between pure pop and R&B.
Come back to me, baby, we can work this out. Oh, baby, come on, let me get to know you. Just another chance so that I can show that I won't let you down enough. No, I won't let you down enough.
Casey Hill, Tom O'Dell, and Dua Lipa are on just about every music critic's watch list to become big stars. And 2016 just might be the year that happens.
Our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Entering its last year in office, the Obama administration has made it clear that engagement with Asia continues to be a top priority, with an agenda that includes economic, security, and political cooperation with Asian partners. In 2016, the United States will push for approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement between 12 Pacific Rim countries. The United States will also continue to modernize its alliances and to deepen security relationships with emerging partners. In the Asia-Pacific region, the United States is ready to support its allies in building maritime security, humanitarian disaster relief, and counter-piracy capacity. Maritime security and territorial issues will be clearly on the agenda this year as well, said Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications Ben Rhodes during a recent speech at the Washington Foreign Press Center. The United States is committed to upholding freedom of navigation, he said. On issues like the South China Sea disputes, we'd like to encourage all parties to de-escalate tensions and resolve their issues through international law. The United States will also continue to cooperate with China on issues of common interest. So, for example, last year, one of the biggest issues that we focused on domestically and internationally was climate change, said Mr. Rhodes.
We would not have achieved the Paris Agreement without the cooperation that the United States and China had on that issue, both in terms of the announcement made in Beijing during his last trip and the subsequent cooperation leading into Paris.
We are going to work very closely with China on a whole range of issues related to the Asia-Pacific, said Mr. Rhodes. For example, we'll be working with China through the UN Security Council and also in our own bilateral discussions about how to demonstrate to North Korea that its recent nuclear test and the threat it poses to our allies and to the world will lead to greater costs, consequences, and isolation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.